Coming up on Boston Public Radio, an eclectic mix on this Friday before Christmas. We start with a former Olympian, now a BC law student, who along with Billie Jean King comprised two openly gay members of the presidential delegation to the Sochi Olympics in gay, unfriendly Russia. Then fruitcake. Love it? Hate it? We'll debate it. Then 12:30 to 1:30, it's Governor Patrick in studio on the latest on missing Jeremiah Oliver, governor's trip to Asia, guns, and all your questions.
Followed by our news quiz starring battling musicians Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops, and WCRB's Brian McCreath, who also produces the Pops, and BSO for CRB. All that's coming up today on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. How many shopping days left till Christmas, Jim?
Four.
Thank you very much.
You're in trouble.
Get going.
I'm fine. I think we're talking about you. So earlier this week, as you probably know, President Obama named two openly gay sports stars to his delegation to the Winter Olympics in gay, unfriendly Russia. Tennis legend Billie Jean King and ice hockey silver medalist Caitlin Cahill. Caitlin has local ties. You probably know she's a Harvard grad, currently at BC Law School. Caitlin, congratulations and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So, Caitlin, how'd you find out? Did you pick up the phone and it was Barack Obama on the other end, or what exactly happened?
Well, I did get a call from the White House. It wasn't the president himself, but whenever the White House calls your phone, it's a pretty exciting occurrence. So I was elated immediately. I couldn't believe it.
Well, we read in one account of this that you were actually taking a constitutional law final. Is that true?
That's accurate. I found out at about 4:30 in the afternoon, and the next morning I had a 9 a.m. con law final. So not a whole lot of studying happened between the announcement and my exam, but I feel pretty good about the exam, so hopefully that went all right.
Oh, good. We hope it went all right for you, too. So do you know, what are you guys going to do over there as part of this delegation? I mean, what's the schedule? What's the deal?
Well, we're going to be attending events and meeting with athletes and dignitaries and generally being there and having our presence and support of all of the great American athletes who are there competing.
You have to love this. I mean, the fact that Vladimir Putin has such a horrible record on gay rights at the same time that, what was it, just yesterday in New Mexico, the state Supreme Court became, I think, the 17th jurisdiction that allows for gay marriage. And you and Billie Jean King are going there is such, I think, a terrific statement by Barack Obama in the United States. How are you feeling about this?
Well, I'm thrilled, you know, and I think it goes beyond just Russian policy. I'm thrilled to be an American at this point in history when we made the most dramatic shift on these issues in the last several years. It's a really exciting time. I'm really excited, not just for the LGBT community, but for all Americans. This is a really great moment in time for us.
You know, you're a former Olympian. I want to ask you what that is like. I can't even imagine the anxiety and excitement and all that sort of stuff. But as a U.S. athlete in the past and going in this delegation, the current members of the team, is your sense that there'll be disappointment that neither the president nor the vice president, actually, nor his wife, that none of them are coming? Does that, and I assume they ordinarily greet the athletes, is that going to lead to some level of disappointment?
Absolutely not. I mean, as an athlete, the culmination of your career is really the Olympics. This is the pinnacle of any athlete's achievement. So I think all the athletes are focused on giving their best performance and bringing honor to themselves and to the United States. And I know that every athlete understands and knows and appreciates the fact that the president will be cheering them on louder than anyone from the White House.
We're talking with Caitlin Cahill, retired American ice hockey player for the U.S. women's national ice hockey team. She's going to go over to the delegation to the Olympics in Russia. Have you met Billie Jean King before, the famous tennis player? Is it going to be the first time?
I've actually brushed shoulders with her before in the past, but we've never really sat down and had a conversation. Obviously, she's a huge idol of mine. I mean, if it weren't for women like Billie Jean King, Title IX wouldn't have happened, and I probably wouldn't have gotten the opportunity to play college hockey at Harvard University. So I admire her for so many reasons that extend well beyond her position as an LGBT advocate.
Well, tell us, you played, as you just said, hockey at Harvard University. How'd you go from, I know you played it in high school, obviously, you played it in college. How'd you get to the Olympics?
Well, Harvard has a really great program. I just wanted to toss that in there, a little shout-out to the Harvard women's hockey team. They have a great program, and I played for Katie Stone, who's the current Olympic team coach. We had a very successful team when I was at Harvard, and I got noticed by the U.S. hockey team and got to try out, and the rest is history. I mean, it turned from being something that I loved and was passionate about and worked really hard for into a really fantastic athletic career, and representing my country was the most important part of that for me.
So, Caitlin, for all the parents out there that want to have future Olympians themselves, how old were you when you first got on the skates?
Oh, my gosh. Well, my mom had been a figure skater growing up.
Yeah.
She hates when I tell this story, but she actually wanted me to be a figure skater. I'm actually named after Caitlin Carruthers.
Oh, that's great.
Which is like a fun bit of irony. So she had me on skates as soon as I could walk.
Okay.
And some of my fondest memories of being with my mom are on skates at Ingalls Rink down at Yale University.
Hey, you were in Turin was one of the two Olympics you were in. Which was the other one, Caitlin?
Vancouver.
When you march in that opening ceremony and you hear the national anthem and when you hit the ice for the first time, what's that like? What's it like?
It feels like a shockwave is sent through your body. I mean, even just thinking about it now, I still get shivers. There is no other experience like it. If you're an athlete, being able to skate out onto that ice or walk out into the arena wearing red, white, and blue is the absolute pinnacle of your career. And it's an incredible moment that I'll never forget.
Okay, Caitlin, you have to make a choice right now. Silver medal or law review at BC Law School? Which do you take?
Wow, thanks for painting me into a corner. I think I'm going to have to go silver medal.
I'm glad.
I really admire the BC Law Review. There's no diplomatic answer to that question.
Okay.
I think you made the right choice. Hey, Caitlin, congratulations. We're thrilled you're representing the country and us. It's great. I hope you enjoy it.
Thanks for being with us, Caitlin. Caitlin Cahill, as I said, a retired American ice hockey player for the U.S. Women's National Ice Hockey Team.
That's great.
And she has been named to the Sochi Olympic delegation for the United States, of course. And again, Caitlin, thanks for being with us. When we come back from the sublime to sort of the ridiculous.
Well, that's what you think.
Okay. It's another holiday quick hit. Fruitcake? Love it or lump it? We want to hear from you. Do you like those green and red jelly nuggets buried within a heap of spice dough? We're going to debate fruitcakes up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
For some small towns and cities in this country, the best way forward is to keep an eye on the past.
The orange industry for the city of Redlands is actually, from an economic or financial point of view, minute. But from a heart share point of view, it's absolutely huge.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, another installment of American Futures with Jim Fallows from The Atlantic. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and AAA Southern New England, helping and serving members for more than 110 years with roadside assistance, insurance and financial products, and a full-service travel agency. Details at AAA.com. AAA, membership for life. And Mr. Stink, Hugh Bonneville stars as a smelly tramp who befriends a young girl. She quickly learns that there's more than meets the nose when it comes to the man living in her garden shed. Watch Mr. Stink, Sunday at 8 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brown. She's Marjorie Egan. The governor will join us in studio at the bottom of the hour. But first, we're going to tackle yet another one of the tough issues that confronts all of us.
Very tough.
Come Christmas time. One word, fruitcakes. Where are you on this dense brown mound? Is it the best thing about the holidays? Do you only surrender to it when it's the last edible thing? It's hanging around the office. Do you buy it? Do you bake it? Or do you toss it? The number is 877 301-8970. I just read something a couple of minutes ago where a huge huge fruitcake advocate says that all of the people, it's sort of like book burning, that they can, that when you want to ban a book, the vast majority of people who want to ban a book have never read the book that they want to ban. This contention in the New York Times from a couple of years ago was that those who hate fruitcakes have never tried one. Have you tried one, Marjorie?
I have.
What do you mean you? I have.
Well, it was not a good fruitcake experience for me. But other people, I guess, they had to be moist, and that's one of the problems. So I guess you're supposed to add more liquid, as in liquor, to the fruitcake to make it more moist, and that's supposed to be the trick. But then you worry that it hangs around for too long. That's the thing. People, you know, that was one of the great jokes I was reading about fruitcakes this morning. It said Johnny Carson made, you know, a million years ago and said that there was only one fruitcake in the world, Jim. It is very heavy, and people keep sending it to each other. And that's one of the theories, that they're like 5 years old, these fruitcakes. They last forever.
Can I tell you?
And they do have the weird, that pockmarked and diseased look. You know what I mean?
So what's wrong with that?
They really, and they have the candied fruit pieces.
I love the candied fruit
pieces.
But they look
kind of radioactive.
No, let me explain something.
I mean, they're not normal.
The candied
looking
fruit pieces as standalones are atrocious. The candied fruit pieces as part of a fruitcake are spectacular. 877. Oh, yeah, don't look at me like that.
You like it? So you like it?
I love it.
I didn't know that.
And the heavier and denser, the better. 877-301-8970. Before we get to your calls on Wednesday, I think it was 2 days ago, a caller to this show talked about the ultimate regifting incident in her family. We were talking about regifting. When her grandmother gave her mom fruitcake for Christmas. Listen up.
One year she gave my mother fruitcake from Stanley Farmers. And when my mother opened the fruitcake, it was moldy.
Ah!
So my mother took the subway to Park Street, marched into Fanny Farmer. They looked absolutely horrified and said, "We haven't made this in over 5 years."
So what's the problem? I mean, I understand what that woman was complaining about.
It's disgusting.
The shelf life, it's like nuclear waste. It's has roughly the same shelf life.
Do you know that they have every year out in someplace in Colorado, they have the annual Great Fruitcake Toss?
I've been there many I missed last summer or last winter, whatever it was.
You get the concussion and you're out of commission for about 6 months.
No, I think there's a bias against fruitcakes, and I totally agree with that New York Times writer from a few years ago. The vast majority of people who trash fruitcake as a Christmas item have never tried a fruitcake. Let's find out what our listeners think. Let's start in Worcester, where Tony is on the phone. Tony, you're welcome to Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Hey, what's up?
What's up? Let's see now. The best fruitcake in the world is from Collins Street Bakery in Austin, Texas.
It's a long way away.
It's delicious.
Yeah.
The ratio of fruit to cake is like 90% fruit.
Ooh.
There's just enough cake just to bind the fruit together.
Wow.
Now, Tony, how do you get the fruitcake from Texas?
You order it.
What's the name of the joint again?
Collins Street, Collin.
Mm-hmm.
Bakery.
Got it. No, how do you know about this?
Oh, my God. I don't know if it was Gourmet Magazine or Bon Appetit. Maybe 30, 40 years ago it was written up.
Let me tell you something, Tony. Whenever Marjorie writes down anything that a guest or a caller is saying, it will happen. So when we talk to you, maybe in late January, early February, Marjorie will have consumed a Collins Street Bakery fruitcake.
Have you got your fruitcake for this year, Tony?
No, I haven't.
And Cody, one last thing about
down on the job.
Well, it's not Christmas time. One last question. My view on the fruitcake is you can just cut off the mold and eat the rest. Is that where you are on the issue?
I used to give one of my aunts, who also loved fruitcake, a Collins Street fruitcake Christmas.
Sure.
And she would take a slice every single day, and it lasted for a year.
That is one of the most beautiful stories we've ever heard on the show, Tony. Thank you.
If you would take a slice, refrigerate it.
Yeah, we got it.
Enjoy it.
We're going to do it.
Okay.
Tony, we're ordering either later today or over the weekend. Tony, thanks for the suggestion.
You're more than welcome.
Bye.
Merry Christmas. I have a problem with baked goods, as you may have noticed. I like them airtight because I want them really fresh.
I understand that.
And that is the other thing about fruitcakes.
What?
There can be nothing that you eat that's in the bakery category that you want to have after like a week.
That
never
is totally
mind
untrue.
A year. Oh, please, unless you freeze it.
Well, so you freeze it. You cut off a little piece, you freeze it, you defrost it. By the way, yeah. You can clearly, there's no meat in a fruitcake.
I know that.
You can refreeze it. You defrost it, you refreeze it.
No matter how well you wrap it up, things get freezer burn after a certain amount of time, and it's certainly long before a year.
No, I think Tony knows what she's talking about. I'm buying one of those babies. Sheila, you're in Norton. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Where are you on the zen of the fruitcake?
Oh, well, Merry Christmas, and to I'm going to wax poetic about fruitcakes.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, I know there's a term that they say the definition of eternity is two people and a ham, but I think it can also be two people and fruitcakes. I shared a great love of fruitcake with my father. My mother used to have to hide it, and it was the Jane Parker Ann Page A&P fruitcake.
Oh, man.
And I don't know if you remember it, but it was so dense it could be like a doorstop or something.
Perfect.
But it was excellent. I think the green little things in there are citron. I think that's what they call them. But anyway, since then, they have someone has taken over the recipe out of Canada, and if you Google Ann Page or Jane Parker, if you're a fan of that,
I'm
writing it down.
You can get it. But I have a cute story. When my husband and I were dating, we just had met over Christmas time. He came to my apartment and he brought the fruitcake, and it was that one.
Oh,
and
man.
He had no idea that I liked it. And I thought, that's it. He liked it and I liked it.
What a romantic. He's unbelievable. Sheila, are you calling from the bunker in Framingham, or what's the deal here?
Oh, do I sound? I'm terrible. I have a cold, too.
Terrible.
It's okay.
Kathleen Fernrich. But you guys have a wonderful holiday.
Hey, Sheila, I heard your book signing last week was a huge success, so congratulations. What's the name of the book,
by
the way? Great Christmas present for kids. What's the name of it?
Thank you, Jim and Marjorie. It's Willow's Walkabout, about a little tour around Boston from Wallaby, based on a true story, and it was a great success, so thanks for mentioning
it. It really is in the class and then some of Make Way for Ducklings. It is a great book.
Well, it's all these different spots all around Boston, and the
great book.
She wrote it, and the illustrator is brilliant. It's a great book. You know, some more fruitcake facts here, Jim.
What are the fruitcake facts?
Supposedly, there was a fruitcake found in King Tut's tomb.
I did know that.
And that Romans were big on
Who wouldn't know that?
On fruitcake with pine nuts and pomegranate seeds. I don't know how that sounds.
You know, what I got
people
for
have
a friend.
Broken their teeth, you know.
I got for fruitcake. A friend, and I know that he's not listening, so I can say this. I actually got him a slice from King Tut's fruitcake for Christmas, and I think it's going to 877-301-8897. This is one of the great debates. And I'm telling you, if you think we're exaggerating the passion with
which
people embrace hate, then just Google it. Go online. This is from the New York Times to blogs.
Like Neil Diamond. There are two kinds of people in the world, those who love him, those who hate him. There are two kinds of people in the world, those who love the fruitcakes and those who just do not want them.
Now, who said
them.
That? Who said
Others
that?
Think that they are a victim of bad publicity.
Who said the Neil Diamond thing?
I think you've said that.
No, I know I've said it, but what's the source of it? Because it's another great movie to watch over Christmas for those who are off for a few days.
I forget.
It's a movie that I love that you only like. What about Bob?
What about Bob?
Exactly.
Yeah. Jim raved about this for about 7 years. I finally went out and rented it. I was so
Fabulous.
Disappointed. But that's not as bad as the other one that you raved about for like 10 years.
I know it's not. No, I don't want to get into it. 877-301-8970. This is a little embarrassing.
Awful.
We have the governor coming at the bottom of the hour. We have to figure out how we explain to the governor that we're debating fruitcake. Before he joins us for an hour. And
I
by the way, he will take your calls.
He'll break the tie.
Well, you know, he's a big-time chef, by the way. I'd be interested to hear what he thinks about your fruitcake conundrum. And you're in North Falmouth. You are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Hi, Ann.
I am a proponent of fruitcake. I grew up in the Irish tradition where we made a fruitcake with our mother every Christmas. Fruitcake was considered a luxury as the fruit put into the cake was expensive.
Yes.
So you purchased, you know, your raisin sultanas gradually over the coming weeks. And then just before Christmas, we made the cake. And to prevent the cake from drying out, Marjorie, you would add a little bit of whiskey to the top of the cake every week before it was cut. There's also the tradition that wedding cakes also were luxury items, so they were also made with fruit. And the top tier of a wedding cake was never cut and served on the day of the wedding. Mm-hmm. This was wrapped in aluminum foil and put into a tin box. And this was used for the christening of the first baby, which presumably will be born within the year. And it was never, ever stayed. fail.
Now,
never
Anne,
failed, she says.
Anne, I want to know, Irish woman to Irish woman, generally speaking, we're not great cooks. Is that correct?
There's certain things that we cook very well.
Yeah, I do potatoes.
Fried dinners and fruitcake, because you always had your granny and your mother standing beside you. There was some disasters, like you couldn't come in for midnight mass and slam the door because the fruit would fall to the back bottom of the cake, and that would be an utter disaster.
Hey, Anne, you're great. Don't go away for a second. When you say that the way to keep it moist is you pour a little whiskey
or
on it
brandy.
Once a week.
Some people do brandy,
so
right,
So how
Anne?
Far in advance of Christmas do you make it? How many weeks are you pouring whiskey or brandy
about on? About 4 weeks.
Great.
Beforehand.
Sounds great.
And you add the drop of whiskey. But I do have another family story.
Go ahead.
About a disaster of a Christmas cake.
Oh, please share
like
it. Yes, please, please.
We're going back many years to actually the war. And during wartime, you couldn't get raisins and sultanas in Ireland because was ships being not importing all these luxuries.
Right.
And it was very difficult. However, we did have relatives in Vancouver who mailed to my aunt these luscious sultanas and raisins and spices. So they made the Christmas cake and everybody was excited. Not only did we have the cake, we had the plum pudding. And everybody enjoyed it enormously. Then January 3rd, we got a letter from the relatives in Vancouver to say, hopefully you had a happy Christmas and you got the fruit. And we included Uncle Albert's ashes with his request that they would be added to the River Slaney in Wexford.
Oh, no.
And you are a great storyteller. And Merry Christmas and thank you so much.
That was great.
And a Merry Christmas to you.
Merry
Bye-bye.
Christmas, Anne.
Hey,
thank
Anne, stay in line. Anne, stay in line 1 second. One of our producers wants to talk to you for a second. Thanks so much.
Okay,
for the,
thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Don't go away.
Anne's got a great voice, doesn't she?
And also, she's a great storyteller. Jack, you're in Westboro. I have a feeling you're not on Anne's side of the fruitcake ledger. Is that correct?
That is correct. And can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, I am decidedly in the negative column on fruitcake, and I have a strong feeling on this matter.
Why is that?
And it has to do with, childhood experiences and exposures, not only to fruitcake, but I would draw two other analogies, one of which is hot cross buns at Easter. The other is raisin cookies. And these things all together, I think, cause a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder in children. These are not good things. People don't enjoy them. They contain fruit that is the likes of which is not found in nature. And, you know, I think there's no better way at the holidays to say, I really don't care about you at all. I'm just doing something perfunctory, so I'm sending you a fruitcake.
Well, I think even though I'm a pro fruitcake person, I have to agree. Well, if you've made it yourself, do you still feel the same way if someone gives you a fruitcake that they have actually made, like Anne described it a couple of minutes ago?
Well, that's a fair point, and
thank you.
And it's on that note, and that's a good point, Jim. And to your point, you know, I think I have to say I try a lot of fruitcakes. I go back and I do try them, and on occasion the homemade one is somewhat tolerable, you know. But by and large, every time I do it, I ask myself, why did I even take one bite of this thing? It's just not good food.
Jack, well, at least you're open-minded. Thank you so much for sharing your opinion on this, too. People have fairly strong opinions.
When was the last time you had a fruitcake?
What's that?
I'm just wondering.
I don't know what I need to date.
When the last time?
November 24th.
You know,
How do I know?
Was it since after the turn of the century?
I think it was during puberty, actually. How do I know? I don't know. I don't have
You're
them every year.
You're waxing rhapsodic about
I wouldn't go
cakes.
Out and buy one, but when I've been
I'm
in a place
suspicious.
That has a fresh one, I
really?
Like them. I
okay.
like them. Let's
All
go
right.
to Providence, Rhode Island, where Susan is on Boston Public Radio. Welcome. How are you, Susan?
Good. How are you?
We're great. Thank you.
Okay. So quick story. My husband and I were invited over to our good friend's apartment for their first Christmas together after they got married. So we brought a bottle of wine, and then we stopped at the local, the 7-Eleven. We brought a fruitcake.
From 7-Eleven.
From 7-Eleven. Now, the thing is, we have it still going back and forth. We send it at different times of year. You never know when you're going to get it. And it has to be about 20 years old.
Oh, God. That's great.
It's the same packaging, everything.
Did you hear the first caller to the show who said that Austin, Texas, this, what is it, Colin Bakery has the best fruitcakes?
I think 7-Eleven has the stuff that works best.
That's what I was going to
ask. Pretty good.
That's what I was going to ask you. 7-Eleven or Colin Bakery over there, Colin Street Bakery in Austin. Susan, thank you for your 7-Eleven experience, Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you too. Moses, apparently, was a big fruitcake fan.
Are you making this stuff up or are you reading from articles?
And from an article that says fruitcake is no laughing matter. Hmm. It lists all the big fans of fruitcake down through the centuries.
I mean, you're not a fabulous. You have one signature dish. As people, chicken marabella is the only thing Marjorie's made for about 40 years.
That's right.
No, I mean,
come to
you're
my
good
house
at,
for dinner.
No,
that's
really
what
good.
You're eating.
Okay, you're really good with chicken marabella. Yeah, how do you?
Otherwise known as prune chicken.
Prune chicken. Okay, fine. Do you have any? How do you candy a piece of fruit? Do you have any idea how you do that?
I have no idea, but they marinate it. In these stories, they say people marinate the fruit? In brandy or whiskey, I guess, in the Anne's case from Ireland, for months. So it gets really toxic. It gets really, I guess you can get a buzz if you eat enough fruitcake and get a little buzz on from the fruitcake. So then maybe one of the kids try to steal it at Christmas time.
And by the way, for those, we're getting some emails that I know that no one wants to leave the fruitcake discussion, but the governor is just a couple of minutes away. And by the way, speaking of politics and policy, Barack Obama is having a year-end press conference at right about 2 o'clock, which WGBH radio will carry live. So don't miss that either. Again, the governor just a couple of minutes away. We are talking fruitcakes.
Fruitcake.
There is a big debate throughout the land and
huge,
apparently beyond our borders, based upon Anne from North Falmouth, about the appropriateness and the desirability,
yep,
of eating, giving, making fruitcakes around Christmas time. And you can hear from these calls, there are clearly two sides of the question.
There are two sides. I mean, it is a huge thing. I think Fox News and MSNBC are going to be debating
it. It's huge. No, can you see Bill O'Reilly in a SmackDown with,
that's,
I don't
right,
know, Chris Matthews over
Chris
this?
Chris Matthews and Bill O'Reilly great? Over the fruitcake. I think O'Reilly would be with the fruitcake. He's,
I think,
a traditional,
he might be,
kind of guy.
I think so, yeah.
Bruce from Newburyport. What do you think about the fruitcakes, Bruce?
I think they're great. Great energy source. If you hike, if you cycle, they last forever. You cut them into little squares, put them in the back of your jersey. You're on the road. You need some carbs. They're just great.
You know, that,
okay,
you know, by the way, but don't let Bruce go yet.
No, I'm not.
His idea
know.
Is brilliant. Sometimes we look at each other during the show.
Yep.
Do you feel low energy at some point?
That's right.
If we just cut up leftover fruitcake from Christmas and popped it in our pockets or something, like Bruce. So what do? You just have it in your backpack or something and pop a little piece in?
I put it in my backpack or when I'm riding. I put it in the back of my cycling jersey.
That's
and, you know, it'd be the same as using a Clif Bar. Same type of thing, which is a carbohydrate, high energy.
It's a great idea.
Now, Bruce,
get some power.
As a healthy guy, where do you get your fruitcake?
I try to buy a high quality fruitcake through the internet. There's a couple in Texas. They come to Texas. The other thing is the Italians make something called pianoforte, strong cake.
Yes,
which is a fruitcake. Without all the, it's mostly fruit, it's very dense, nuts, and it only has a little bit of binder in it.
Yeah, someone...
So, and it's sold by the kilo, or you can get sort of round, circular ones. They're pretty pricey, but if you go to Italy, you can buy them. It's a Tuscan thing. You can buy them there, throw them in your suitcase, and bring them back. I hand them out as gifts, usually.
Okay. Yeah.
The other thing is, fruit is candied. It's candied fruit is cooked in sugar water.
That's what I thought. Sugar water. That makes
sense.
Yeah,
sugar water.
Sense. Hey, Bruce. Merry Christmas. Happy holiday. All that stuff.
Merry Christmas to you.
Thanks for all that.
Eat the fruitcake.
Well, I'm doing it. Marjorie's the problem here. It's pretty obvious. Bruce,
I'm not
into
it.
Marjorie, eat the fruitcake.
Okay,
you know,
I'll try it just for you.
Okay.
You know what I'm doing?
Okay,
thank you.
What are you doing?
In light of what Bruce is saying, when I am planning, I think the day after Christmas, I'm thinking of running up Mount Washington. when I do, I'm thinking of stashing a couple of little chunks of fruitcake in the back of my jersey.
Well, you take a selfie halfway up the mountain.
I will.
We'll take it from there.
Yeah. Well, if I don't run it, I will drive it. One of the...
That's what I always love. The bumper stickers on the cars, this car climbed Mount Washington. You're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to say, I climbed Mount Washington.
I understand that.
Then you get kind of come through. If you ever climb Mount Washington?
No, but you know that when I went to Yosemite, I've told you this, after I graduated from law school, and I hiked up a side of a mountain. Hike, not climb.
The Rangers had to intervene.
I was never more proud of myself. This is true. I had like a 40-pound backpack. I'm hiking up to the top, and I'm other people are falling by the wayside. Literally, I am so proud of myself. It's a totally true story. I get to the top of this mountain, mm-hmm. about 50 feet from the top. I finally get there. I've never been prouder of myself. You know what's on the top of the mountain? A hot dog stand and 50 people parked in a parking lot they had driven. In any case, I know it's really sad. We've got to leave the fruitcake behind. We hope we helped you out. Governor's coming up in a couple of seconds, so don't go away.
Next time on The World, reliving the 1960s in China, this Red Guard-themed restaurant reenacts scenes from Chairman Mao's Cultural Revolution. It's being played for laughs, but it also dredges up some dark memories of brutality and betrayal. Why some old-timers are looking back at the Cultural Revolution and saying they're sorry. Our story from Beijing on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru Forester with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com. And Fenway Park Tours, now offering educational tours year-round for children, young adults, and history enthusiasts. You can visit redsox.com/tours for more information. That's redsox.com/tours.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And joining us, as he is kind enough to do every month, to take our questions and yours, is Governor Deval Patrick.
Kindness has nothing to do with it.
What is it about? Why do you keep reappearing here every single month?
It's Marjorie.
Why, thank you, Governor.
That's why I come Marjorie. Every
thank
day,
you, Governor.
Too.
It's Marjorie, yes. That's why it's always troubling when you're not here.
It is troubling when I'm not here.
Jim apparently never takes vacation.
Our number, by the way, in the governor's is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
Hello to you both.
And as you know, it's good to see you, Governor. Welcome
good to
back
see you
from
too.
Asia. You can email us at bpr@wgbh.org. And as you know, whatever questions the governor does not answer during the hour he's here are forwarded to his office and his people will respond.
Yeah, we wanted to ask you all about Asia in just a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. We thought we'd get some big news stories out of the way first. The first one, of course, is the 5-year-old Jeremiah Oliver from Fitchburg.
Yes.
The little boy who's missing and feared dead. The social worker and supervisor who were supposed to be protecting this little kid and his mm-hmm. siblings, they've been fired mm-hmm. Because the social worker didn't visit the child's home as she was supposed to. Mm-hmm. And you defended the head of the Department of Children and Families and said she shouldn't resign, but she should get to the bottom of this. But one of the issues, as you know, Governor, is that this particular social worker, and this is not obviously to excuse her, but she did file 6 grievances since May about her caseload being overwhelming. This is one of the recurring themes that these social workers have supposed to have 15 cases and have 20 or more. Any news on this or any reaction to what's gone on since we last saw the stories in the paper?
So the obviously I'm as concerned as you are, and I think any decent person is about Jeremiah and his whereabouts. Indeed, the older kids, the brother and sister, I'm worried about them too because I've been briefed on their condition and their experience. And without crossing a line into what is not public and won't be, I can tell you it's a pretty grisly story.
Yeah.
Really troubling story. And a family that's been involved with DCF for a long time. The social work provided to the family up until the end of last year was exemplary. It was in a different office, a different social worker, a different different team, really terrific. The problem, again, based on what I know so far, seems to have been about the social worker who was fired from the office to which it was transferred, and her supervisor. And I'm going to hold my fire at that point because I've asked the commissioner to look into the question about whether responsibility goes beyond those two. And I have some reason to believe that it does. I can tell you that the question of people being overextended is a serious one.
Yeah.
But it's just a separate one. I mean, you can't be so busy that a family with these many 51As, you know, the emergency
right.
Petitions, isn't cause for you to raise the question with somebody. I'm not talking about a grievance. I'm talking about saying to somebody, "We got a problem here, and I can't get to it because I'm too busy." That didn't happen. In fact, what happened is a representation was made in the summer last year, and you'll hear more about this soon, that the family was fine and was in a new apartment with brand new furniture, and that was not true because no one had actually gone to see that. Being busy doesn't explain that kind of thing away.
Yeah.
Speaker DeLeo's quote, I think, in the Herald this morning, Governor, saying that he doesn't think there's a funding shortage at DCF, Department of Children and Families. Do you agree with him?
I think the speaker would agree with me and with most people that their resources are strained. It's not unusual in state government these days. You know, we've reduced headcount by over 6,000 positions over the last several years. But, you know, my point is that there are two serious issues here, but they are not connected in this case. That's all I'm saying. The issue of Jeremiah Oliver and his brother and sister and that family and their involvement with DCF is a very serious issue. It's being taken very seriously. It is very upsetting to me personally. But the question of caseload by DCF social workers is a separate one from this, also an important one. And can I just say one other thing?
Sure.
You know, the social workers at DCF perform hundreds of miracles a day.
They do.
They do fabulous, fabulous work under really tough circumstances. That does not get noticed because it's kind of taken for granted. It's or whatever it is. It just doesn't get noticed. Once in a while, there is a horrible tragedy like this. And I got to tell you, they feel that team feels as badly about this as you and I do, and many of your listeners too. And we'll get to the bottom of it. And at the end of the day, I think folks will accept both inside and outside the agency the importance of there being swift and certain accountability.
Very quickly, just to tie this thing up, my understanding, and I want to confirm it, is one of the things you've ordered the commissioner there to do is to make sure that there are no other Jeremiah Oliver situations, meaning there are no other homes that are not being visited as
required.
Is that what's going on right now?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And I should – can I just – Oh,
sure,
sure,
sure.
I want to change the subject, but the child advocate, which was a position created by the legislature, an independent position created by the legislature a few years ago and very, very ably led by Judge Gail Garinger, is conducting a separate interview, systemic review. I said interview. I meant review of systems in that office and in DCF, just as a kind of belts and suspenders here.
One last thing that's been in the news, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Your much younger cousin – well, not much, but he's younger. Reynolds Windersmith Jr. From Illinois is one of several – what are you laughing
is
at?
Is that bizarre or what?
Okay. Well, let me just tell people who don't know
okay.
about this.
Okay.
He was one of several prisoners yeah. that had a very long sentence commuted. He's been in jail since 1994
yeah.
by President Obama, citing a disparity in the sentencing for crack cocaine
yeah.
dealings. And I just want to make sure of a couple of things. What your office has said, you have no recollection of meeting this young guy
yeah.
who's 39 now. You weren't involved in any application for commutation, learned of it through the media reports. That's all correct?
That's all right.
But it's not unreasonable to think. And if I were this guy, I certainly would say, in all, because he's been the subject of a crusade by many young
yeah,
lawyers
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and by the ACLU, that you wouldn't put in there somewhere. I certainly would, that my cousin was the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and the White House might have known that. So did they alert you that he was on this list?
No.
No.
No, I would tell you, first of all, my I know this man exists.
Yep.
I didn't know of his involvement with the you know, I didn't know of his imprisonment, but my uncle, my mother's brother was himself a heroin addict and was in and out of the same tenement where I lived with my mom, my sister, and my grandparents from time to time. And he was married. He's passed away now. He was married at least three times that
he's
I know
of. He's the father of this
young
guy.
He's the father, right. And he was married at least three times that I know of, or had families with three different women that I know of. I actually don't know whether he was actually married. There were two older boys who were around my age, and I was close to when I grew up. I'm not so much now. I think one of them has passed away. My sister told me that last night. The oldest had been involved in the criminal justice system as well, and I think is out now and living with his family, my sister says, in Virginia. And then there was, by another mother, a daughter who was a baby when, you know, my sister and I were sort of, I want to say, 7 or 8 years old. And she lived with us, and we're very close. And she lives in Chicago, is married, and has a kid. She lived with us for a time. And then I left, remember, at 14.
To go to Milton County.
To go to Milton. And I was home from time to time through my time in Milton, but not much at all when I was in college. And somewhere in there, my uncle had another family. So I'm 20 years old thereabouts by the time this young man who's in the news today was born. and I have absolutely no memory of ever having met him.
Do you have any thought of contacting him now that he's allegedly going to be out come April? And
no,
by the way, for
so,
those
no,
who
no,
don't,
I, no, I was sorry. Let me go one step further, because you know that my every once in a while Diane will get a lottery card. I mean, a lottery ticket or something like that. Like we do this. Maybe you know people who do this. We get lottery tickets and put them in stockings.
Yeah,
For the family. And every once in a while she'll get one. Every once in a while I'll get one. I said to her, you know what, Diane? If we ever win, no one will believe it wasn't rigged. So let's just accept that going in. So here's why this is particularly bizarre to me. I get an email while I'm away. I think it was Monday or Tuesday. From my assistant Michelle, who has received an email from my sister, whom you've met, I think,
yes.
My sister Ryan,
yes.
Who lives in Milton, who has received an email from the cousin we were close to, who lived with us when we were kids, who lives in Chicago, about this kid, right?
Pre-commutation.
Yes. This is like, you know, Tuesday or something like that. I'm on a flight on the way back. I read this email. And then yesterday, and I'm, you know, I don't do anything about it, but it has the ACLU kind of, you know.
Yeah, they've been involved,
you know,
in trying to help him.
It has their kind of their
letterhead
paragraph worth of argument about
okay.
it. Anyway, I read this thing. I think, wow, that's amazing. And then yesterday, Brendan walks in and says, do you have a cousin named Reynolds Wintersmith? And I said, that is so weird. I just got this email. You know, the other day and blah, blah, he said, well, the president just commuted 8 sentences and one of them was that's why I mentioned the thing about the lottery, because it felt as improbable as
so that. Do you intend to, I mean, when he's out in April, the latest they say is April, do you have any intention of, he is your first cousin, any intention of
contacting?
Yeah,
I mean, I have no relationship with him. I'm not going to avoid him. I'll probably check in with the cousin I do know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she may have a relationship with him. I'm not sure of that either.
Well, here, speaking of the ACLU, here's what he wrote on his ACLU post when he was involved in this effort of trying to get his sentence commuted, that he was raised in a crack and prostitution house where adult members of my family taught me how to cook, package, and sell cocaine. Both of my parents were drug addicts, and he found his mother dead from an overdose when he was 11.
Mm.
Now, you left to go to Milton when you were 14. This guy at 17 starts running a gang. You grew up with this family.
No. Don't confuse that. That's
what?
Not the same household I grew up
okay.
in.
Okay. No, I didn't mean you.
It's a different city.
I didn't mean you grew up with them. I mean,
yeah.
I mean this. You knew. What is amazing to me, what I'm trying to get at here, Governor, is you were the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, Sonny, was in your – this guy's father was in your house, your
mm-hmm.
mother's brother.
Mm-hmm.
You're the governor. He went into a gang
yeah.
and had crack cocaine problems. I mean, It's kind of like, how'd you get what you got? Is there, it your mom, your grandma?
But for the grace of God. You know, I wrote in my book, I write about briefly about Sonny and an unforgettable, for me, unforgettable encounter. Sonny was this young man's
father.
My uncle. And an unforgettable encounter between my mom and her brother one weekend when my grandparents were away and Sonny showed up to stay for a couple of days. And I walked in on him in the front room of the apartment shooting up, and I didn't know what he was doing. My mother was in the back. We had one of these sort of railroad apartments. The tenement was like that. And I went in the back, and I asked my mother what was going on. I don't remember how old I was, maybe 9. I don't know. And my mother, instantly recognizing what this was about, flew into a rage and confronted my uncle, and they got into a screaming match, and then he left, I think with my grandparents' TV to hock it. She then locked him out. So when he came back at night, you know, he's pounding on the door. We're in bed asleep, and she's double locked and bolted the door. He's pounding on the door to be let in, and, you know, and my sister and I are freaking out and scared to death, and my mother's just ignoring it and wouldn't let him in all night. My grandparents come back at the end of that weekend, and my grandmother chews out my mother for locking her brother out of the house. You know, no comment about the shooting up or stealing the TV. I mean, that was some of the dynamic in the place where I was raised. And ours wasn't the only house like that. But, you know, you've heard me talk about it before. You and I have talked about it before. I had the great blessing of having strong adults in the house and strong adults elsewhere in school and in church who paid attention to me and cared about me. And, you know, it's something I feel thankful for every day.
That's the voice of Governor DeVal Patrick. We have a lot more from him, but we figure since the lines have been full since the second he walked in, we should let him take some of your calls. Our number is 877-301-8970. Governor Patrick, all yours. Let's go to the call. Sure.
Is it Rhea? Am I pronouncing it right, Rhea, from Maynard?
Rhea, is that how you pronounce it, Rhea?
Yes, it's Rhea.
Hi, Rhea. You're on with the governor.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
How are you?
I'm great.
Good.
I'm wondering, you must know about the other DSS case that's been in the news in the Globe this week, about the girl...
at Children's Hospital?
Yes, that case.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm really concerned about that one. I'm an adult with mitochondrial disease, which is the disease that she had originally was being treated for by a physician at Tufts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this physician has been 30 years in the field. He is renowned nationwide. And, you know, one of the things that really strikes me about the case and DCF's role in it is that they locked this child in a psychiatric ward for almost a year, and they took Children's word at face value when Children's gave her a different diagnosis from what Tufts gave her. And they never investigated the case. They never spoke. I mean, they did 10 months later. It took them 10 months to speak with her treating physician from Tufts. And they never contacted any of the teachers from her school or other adults that knew her.
Hey, Ray, I'm only going to interrupt you only because a huge number, even though we talked with Brian McGrory from the Globe about it the other day, people may not know, Tufts referred this girl to Children's Hospital, and then subsequently the things you described happened. And I believe there's supposed to be a ruling as early as today as to whether or not she will return to the parents. But is there a question for the governor, Rhea, in there somewhere?
Yes, and right before the question, if I could just say that this isn't the first case, that there have been several, and because you're the governor, I'm specifically honing in on DCF's role. You know, I don't understand how DCF could do this without any investigation, and I wonder if you could comment on that. And in general, what can be done to get both Children's and DCF to start handling these cases differently?
Thank you, Rhea.
Thank you, Rhea. I've read about this case too, and I think it is also true and not surprising that there is more to the story than even in the very thorough reporting that I have read and Rhea that you've read about. It's you know, as a parent, it's troubling. It's worrisome. We all know parents who's you know, we think we are the reasonable parent, but we also know parents who are less so, and where there's more to that story, where those still waters run deep. So I don't want to comment on that particular case because I think there are layers of it, and it's being it is being reviewed and being ruled on independently, Jim, as you said. But I think the question of the larger question is, what is a state agency charged with care and protection of children supposed to do in a gray area, in those delicate areas? You know, there's a view out there in some circles that a child is better under the care of his or her mother or dad. Even if mom and dad are living in a shoebox. And there's another view out there that says that the state through DCF should be interventionist in a way because you always want to err on the side of on the conservative side, if you will, and not risk the kind of thing, you know, that happened in the case of Jeremiah, or that may have happened in the case of Jeremiah, certainly his brother and sister. And I think that every day social workers are trying to find what the right place is in between. I don't think there is a pattern here, with due respect to Rhea's point, but it's certainly a question I'm asking as well as a result of that article. And can I also say, and I know I'm going on too long.
No, you are not at all.
Rhea was made the point that the doctor at Tufts was a nationally renowned physician in his field, and he has a competing view from another nationally renowned group of physicians. And you know, frankly, I'm not in a position to make that call. And I think the question is, who is in the position to make that call when that call has to be made?
Let's go back to the phones. That's voice of Governor Deval Patrick.
Sure.
Governor.
Lee is calling from Worcester. Lee, you there?
Hi, Lee.
Thank you. How are you?
Great.
Thanks for holding.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Welcome home.
Thank you.
First, let me say I hope they find Jeremiah safe and sound.
Yes. Pray for that.
Governor, I am a former Protective Services with DCF. I recently retired after over 30 years.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you for your service.
Tough job, but there's a rewarding experience because there are more successful stories than not.
That's what I said a minute ago.
There are.
You know? My question is this. The department has what they call monthly ticklers. These are computerized forms.
Yeah.
And they report a worker's performance of home visits each and every month.
Yep.
And if the worker does not perform, then the supervisor, the area program manager, and the area director call the social worker in and they have a meeting.
Right.
And at times they can put the social worker on what they call a work plan.
Mm-hmm.
And if things don't improve, then it gets bumped up.
Mm-hmm.
Getting straight to my question, along with concern, is when a tragedy, and this has not even become a tragedy yet, and I hope it's not a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
However, when a case such as this comes to the forefront,
mm-hmm.
it's always the social worker and the supervisor who take the hit, and it stops right there.
Mm-hmm.
In, as you know, large corporations, there's a chain of command, and it certainly would, you know, continue up.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and it falls with other people up above that give the directive. And, of course, direct staff are to follow those requirements. Mm-hmm. And if not, it's up to the chain of command to be aware of such things, especially it's inexcusable if it's gone on for 6 months. And the other concern that I have...
Hey, Lee, I'm sorry to interrupt, only if I can, because there's so many people on the line. Do you have a question for the governor about, based on your experience?
The tickler. So was anyone looking at that tickler? And I know because confidentiality matters. I know, you know you're kind of tied here. That's my concern, the tickler. Where was the tickler, and where was the Erie program manager, along with the rest of the people up the chain of command?
So, Lee, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
They should have known that these visits were not occurring.
I'm sorry.
No, Lee is her name, yeah.
Yeah, so Lee, I have learned in the last few days about that system, the tickler system. There's another term you guys use for it, though, but I know what you mean. And the questions I have asked are about responsibility up the chain. I have some of those answers, but I can't talk about them right now. You're going to hear about them in the next in the next little while, because there are a couple more questions we want to get to the bottom of and we want to give people a chance to answer to, you know, beyond the tickler, to explain the discrepancies to the extent they exist between the procedures and expectations and what the ticklers say. So I think we are following. We're asking the same questions, Lee, that you are asking. And we're following that that trail. I guess I would just say one other thing. When Lee says, let's not call this a tragedy yet, it's already a tragedy. I think what she means is let's hope for the best for Jeremiah.
He's alive. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And that he's found and that he's safe. But knowing what I know about the treatment of the other two children we are and what might have been prevented it's already a tragedy.
Yeah, these two other kids complained to their teachers, and thank goodness for the teachers, that they had been beaten and abused by the mother and the boyfriend.
Let me say that the 51A petitions, they didn't start in November. They go...
51A being what, Governor?
And these are the emergency...
Abuse and neglect.
Petitions.
Required to file if you think a child is being abused or neglected.
Can we?
And the range of places, the range of sources of those complaints is just stunning. It's so sad.
We're going to take a brief break. The governor's with us until the bottom of the hour for our questions and yours. The number to get to him is 877-301-8970. Give us a call. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. This is Ask the Governor. That's the 1 hour a month when the governor comes into our studio and talks to us and talks to you. You can get to him at 877-301-8970. Governor, before we get back to the calls, in the spirit of full disclosure, as I always say to Marjorie, a spirit I rarely embrace, I am one of those people who used to rail against chief executives of states going on foreign missions, allegedly to bring business back to their state or have this business flow back and forth. You just got back from 10 days in Asia. I've been reading a lot about it. What came out of this? What was the benefit for the people of Massachusetts?
Well, a couple things. I mean, there are a couple of hard deals that were signed and announced while we were there. Actually, one of them goes back to Israel, a company we...
Where you were not so long.
Right, exactly. On another trade mission where we met an entrepreneur in the water innovation space. He moved his company here to Massachusetts, and he signed a joint venture with a Japanese company when we were together in Japan last week. We have an energy efficiency company from Massachusetts that signed a joint venture with a Japanese company. Then we've been cultivating these things before the trip, so it wasn't like it happened over coffee while we were... While we were there, we met some extraordinary folks in the transportation space, one of whom had shown some interest in taking the commuter rail contract. Remember that was bid recently?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
and is one of the best, one of the most highly respected operators in the world. And they withdrew before they actually made a bid. And I was really keen to talk with them about why. And I think as we talk with them, there may be some opportunities to think in fresh ways about how they could help us get our system right and better better functioning. We met with a potential manufacturer of the T and Orange Line, the Red and Orange Line contract that we're putting out for new cars, who expressed some interest as a condition of that contract in actually building them in Massachusetts, which would be, you know, something we're very interested in. And otherwise, we met with folks in the those companion or compatible innovation sectors that we that are the high growth sectors here. And in the case of they were a little different in each place. So in Japan, we focused mainly on biotech, high tech, and clean tech. In Hong Kong, we focused on financial services because Hong Kong is, as you may know, really important financial services gateway in Asia. And in Singapore, we focus mainly on the water tech folks, but also biotech and clean tech generally. And it was really useful. And, you know, I've told you before, the nature of business today is not that you take a trip and you come back with a fistful of purchase orders for widgets. You come back with relationships. You open doors. And then you see whether whether businesses will walk through them. If you look back at the report that was released on the Israel trade mission right before we left, which was, what, 2.5 years ago, I want to say, maybe? And it was a look back on what the economic benefits were from that mission. They were pretty darn powerful. But it took time for people to, you know, make the most of relationships we had either freshly made or renewed.
Very quickly, since you mentioned transportation and subway cars and those sort of things, very quickly, one, we're going to get late-night tea service, apparently.
Yes.
You found money for that thing. And if you want any thoughts on that, it's fine. Marty Walsh, I was talking to, interviewing the other night, and he said he likes to think that his advocacy for it helped push this thing along. I'd like to know if it had any impact.
Well, he's the mayor-elect, so the answer to that is
of course
it is.
Of course it is. And secondly, this question is really for Marjorie. Are we going to have a third bridge going to Cape Cod?
Isn't that interesting? You so on the first on the late night on the late night tea service, you know, I knew it was a good idea. We'd heard a lot about it when we were doing the work to get the transportation finance plan ready, the transportation plan, and then the way to finance it. And so it was in the proposal we made at the beginning of the year, and we heard a lot about it from you know, not just the hipsters who want to stay out late on a weeknight. But from you know, hospitals, we have a third shift and what have you, and we didn't feel enough resources in the in what the legislature ultimately did to assure we could sustain it for more than you know, Friday and Saturday night on a trial basis, and we're looking for ways to get some support from businesses to help us sustain it beyond this trial basis.
And universities,
and learn
potentially,
from,
Rich
yes,
Davey told us.
Exactly. But the response has been off the charts.
Yeah.
The excitement about it from merchants, from young people, from workers, from, I mean, all sorts of folks, really, really excited about it. And Boston's a pretty fun town. There's some safety issues that I think are made better by having access to the teeth. So that's really, really good news. I wanted to say, Marjorie, you'd be interested. We have been – so one of the things that the legislature gave us was the latitude to think more broadly about public-private partnerships as a way to – meaning are there private investors you can bring in to help fund public transportation projects? There are not many very good models in the United States.
Well, there's New Balance, though, down the block that's doing the commuter rail thing, correct?
Right. There are not many successful models in the United States. There are many, or there are more of them outside the United States. And we met with one entity that may be interested in investing in a bridge, in that third bridge, for the purpose of having, you know, for the purpose of seeing, of trying to test this idea. I don't get ahead of me. And, you know, Rich is somewhere listening to this saying, oh, God. God,
your secretary.
Yes, Secretary Davey. But, you know, there are funders in that part of the world who are interested in us and interested in this kind of thing. And that was one of the reasons why he was along on the
And so they would so, for example, because there's some roads in this country, not many, that were, that have that relationship. They're built by a private entity, and then they take the toll. So the theory, I don't want to get too far ahead of you either, but the theory would be they invest in this third bridge to Cape Cod, and the tolls would go to them. Is that the theory?
Well, there are a couple different ways of doing it. So I'm not going to suggest that that's the only way. The model a model in the United States is the Skyway in Chicago, mm-hmm. which I can't remember whether it was the mayor or former governor who basically sold it and collect. The Skyway in Chicago was a toll road and sold it and then took the proceeds and used them for operating funds. So that's why I say that's not a very successful model, right? You take the funds, you put it into new capital, you pay down debt, right? You want to treat. That kind of transaction that way, but there are a couple different models. That we met this unbelievable operator of the Hong Kong subway and rail system. They don't do the buses, but they manage the subway, the commuter rail, and then the high speed rail, which is intercity.
It's embarrassing in a way that we're so behind some of these other places.
Well, you know, they have now in effect privatized it. I mean, it's the government is a shareholder in that company, because the way the deal was done was that the debt was given to the company too, and in exchange for the, not given but acquired by the company, in exchange for that, the government gets a seat on the board and shares in the company. And their margin for lateness of trains is measured in seconds. It's not measured in minutes. It's an extraordinary model, but it's not a transportation only model. It's basically a real estate company, right? Because what they do is they build malls and hotels and office buildings on the land where the stations go, which is owned by this company, and that financial model funds the transportation. It's a very, very intriguing model, and it'd be a very new model in the United States.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Sorry, Governor Pat. No, it's up to you.
Sort
Take
of
it away.
Top of mind these days. Charles is calling from Falmouth. Charles, thank you for holding.
Thank you, Governor, for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask for your assurance that those who would be losing their unsubsidized individual health care coverage under the Commonwealth Choice Program,
yep,
will not lose all 2014 coverage at great financial risk through no fault of their own on January 1st if the re-enrollment backlog at the Health Connector, which is reportedly 42,000 people, remains after Monday's deadline, and specifically I'm asking whether you can ensure that those who are paying the full freight,
yep,
at least whatever extension is needed to work through whatever backlog remains on Monday.
Yep, I feel pretty good about this. We've obviously been working on it, Charles, and it sounds like you're very informed. Maybe for the folks who don't know what we're talking about. So, Charles, just let me indulge me just a second for those who may not be as deeply into it as you are.
Sure.
There are two different deadlines that we have to meet. One is the transfer of folks who have been on our own health reform to the ACA qualified programs, and we also have to pick up the relatively small number of people who have not been insured even under our own health reform. And we have two different deadlines for this. One is January 1 and the other is at the end of March. And the reason I think Charles is asking the question is because we have had similar website issues as the national exchanges, the federal exchanges, and we've had to do a whole bunch of workarounds. Been very disappointing performance by our vendor, by the way.
Is this CGI?
Yeah, I'll come. Yeah, we can talk about that another day. But we've done a number of workarounds, and Charles, I feel pretty good. Everybody's going to be okay. I have asked people, I've urged people, I've instructed them to keep their eye on the ball. The ball, in my view, is not just about having a functioning website. It's making sure people are insured and that they don't have a gap in their insurance, which is what your question is about. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to be speaking with Secretary Sebelius at HHS in Washington a little later today on this as well. There's one more workaround that I think is, to use a phrase again I used earlier, kind of a belt and suspenders approach, and I need her to bless that, and I think she will, and you and others who have these concerns will be okay.
Thank you for the call, Charles. You're listening to the voice of Governor Deval Patrick. He's here till the bottom of the hour. And by the way, at 2 o'clock, we will bring you live the year-end press conference from the President of the United States from Washington.
Governor Steve Crosby, who heads the Gaming Commission, has been the subject of a lot of speculation and criticism because he waited a long time to disclose that he had business dealings. They were a while ago, 23 years ago, with one of the owners of the land in Everett that could, of course, be the casino. Now, he has recused himself from voting on that, and but many people think that he should be recusing himself from any kind of vote on any of the Boston area licenses, or even that he should be resigning because his commissionership has been tainted by this failure to disclose, as early as he might have. So
I was waiting for the question there. So
I'm asking so basically what you think. Does he have to recuse himself from the Boston vote? Does he have to recuse himself just from the land vote in which he's said he? Which he has done.
I think that question is between him and the Ethics Commission. I am satisfied with his recusing himself from the land vote. I think he has still yet to make a decision about whether he's going to recuse himself from all of it. I think it is an action he seems to be taking in an excess of caution, because the notion that a relationship that is 23 years stale. I'm not just talking. I mean, they haven't had a relationship for 23 years. It feels like a kind of an inflated concern. But to if I think he's taken the action he has taken in order to quiet people's concerns about optics. I think at the end of the day, substance is more important than optics, and substantively, I just don't. From what I know, I'm just not. I'm not that worried about it.
Well, can I ask about optics and very quickly on this one? The Ethics Commission actually specifically said he did not have to recuse himself from the land vote, but he chose to anyway for appearance, for optics reasons. He's talked a lot about how appearance matters here. I asked him this the other night, and I really don't. And I'm anxious to hear what you think feel about it. Why does appearance matter on a land vote, but appearance does not matter on a more important vote, a final vote, as to whether or not Everett or potentially Revere or potentially nobody gets a casino in Eastern Mass?
So, Jim, what I was saying earlier, at least as I understand it, is that he hasn't made a decision
yet. Well, he says he will not, but I asked him the other day. He said that I could reconsider it, but as of now, he does not plan to recuse himself.
I mean, I would hate to think that the chair was missing from action in critical votes of the commission. The commission has a hugely important role, and we have a very, very thoughtful and I think effective chair. I'm not going to jump up and down if he recuses himself from the final vote, but based on what I know, I'm not troubled that if he votes. And I get your point about if optics is important, but what I said a minute ago, I really believe I get the importance of optics, but I think substance is more important. And if we, we gotta we got to get this done and done right.
Well, you know, that's the ballot question. You know, you're aware of the fact that the attorney general said the ballot question was unconstitutional to repeal the whole casino law that you signed. The SJC is going to rule on this in the interim. A judge has allowed them to collect signatures. They have gotten enough signatures to be on the ballot the same day we elect another governor. Martha Coakley, who at least as of the moment is the leading Democratic candidate, has said she's undecided as to whether or not she'll vote for repeal. Are you not worried as an advocate of this bill that when there's a lawsuit from Caesars, there may be a lawsuit from Revere if they don't get the casino, assuming they win their vote in February, and a ballot question hanging over? As a good business guy like this Wynn guy is, who's going to invest in a casino when come November or whatever it is, it's possible the whole thing disappears? Does that not worry you?
No, not really. That's why we have markets. You know, it's a the expansion of gaming is something I supported, but it's never been central to my economic growth strategy. I've heard loud and clear the concerns for people who think it's a bad idea for a whole host of reasons, and I've reflected on those concerns, and we've talked about a lot of them over the years. And on balance, I thought there was a right way and a wrong way to do this, and that the framework that's set out in the legislation, both the one I proposed and the one the speaker proposed and that we ultimately agreed on, is the right framework. If that framework means that people generally think expansion of gaming is okay, but they don't, but no community says I want it in my community, that may happen. That's within the framework. If it takes some time to sort out and settle the market before we get the level of investment that was forecast in the bill, that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's okay too. I'd like to get this done and resolved, but it is set up really to meaning the bill, the legislation is really set up to allow for this kind of yin and yang and working of it all out.
Governor, I just wonder if you talked to Steve Crosby about why it took him so long to disclose this relationship, even though it was 23 years ago.
Even to you.
Exactly. If you talked to him about why he didn't tell you about this.
You know, Frank, I got to go back to the materials that he sent to me. But I don't feel like this is news for me. I think the question of whether he was going to participate in a vote that was involved a partial interest by somebody he knew 23 years ago is something he flagged early on. I wasn't concerned about it.
You knew it earlier than that.
I think so, but I have to go back and check my documents. I wasn't concerned about it. I'm still not concerned about it. And by the way, I'm not poo-pooing the folks who are.
Yep.
Concerned about it. I'm just saying, you know, 23 years ago is a long time ago not to have any. And it, you know, as far as I have read, the interest of the fellow he knew 23 years ago is also quite small.
By the way, for the whatever it's worth, the Globe said he found out when he was touring the site in Everett with Wynn, maybe in November of last year, and he told you on August 22nd. That lag doesn't trouble you.
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not sure that's exactly right.
Okay. But, let's take another call, Governor, if we can squeeze another
homework.
One. He's Governor Deval Patrick. We're back to the phones.
Luke is calling from Framingham. Luke.
Hi, Luke.
Hi, Governor. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for holding.
My call is about the individual mandate here in Massachusetts and also as compared to federal counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, from your point of view, whether there's a difference in terms of the Commonwealth legislative authority to enact that kind of an individual health care mandate as opposed to the congressional authority under which it was enacted, and also relatedly, whether you have any insights from the operation of the individual mandate here in the Commonwealth over the past few years in terms of how you think the individual mandate on the federal level will play out.
Huh. So on the first question about the legislative authority. I'm a lawyer, but I don't play one on TV anymore.
I think it was the exercise of the taxing power on the federal level.
No, I know. I know. I mean, that's what the Supreme Court held,
Robinson.
Right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas they thought initially it would probably be like a Commerce Clause power. But the Commonwealth's legislature, of course, has more plenary police powers and other state-level powers that
right.
the
Congress lacks. So I was just wondering whether you had any insights on the on that difference.
No, not really. I mean, most states have greater legislative latitude than the federal government does under the federal constitution. It's a kind of a moot or academic question at this point because we're not going to have two mandates. We're only going to have the federal one at this point. I will say, Luke, that if I understand it correctly, to your second question, the way the federal mandate is charged is through the tax code, and the way the state mandate was charged for individuals was also through the tax code. I think I have that right, as opposed to the business one, which I think was more. I may be wrong about that, actually, but anyhow.
Hope you're not looking at me for a legal opinion.
Yeah, somebody. Is there a lifeline?
Not here.
Is there a lifeline?
No.
But continue.
But I guess I would. What I was going to say, I may be saying in a more general way. I feel like the state plan was simpler to explain to people and also to effectuate than the federal plan. But I understand why the federal plan is what it is. It is similar in a lot of ways. Sounds like you're very familiar with the two, but there was a lot more compromise. And you know, I want this sentence from this congressperson, the other one saying I want that sentence than what happened in Massachusetts in 2006. So I'd say ours was a lot more straightforward. And the other benefit we have, which goes a little afield of your question, is that the broad coalition that invented healthcare reform in Massachusetts stuck together to refine it as we've gone along. And that's been enormously important because we've learned as we've gone along and we've needed to make changes to make it better.
Governor, Luke from Framingham, thank you for your call. You know, in a couple of minutes, I don't know if you know, we do a Friday news quiz every Friday, Governor. We've been trying to get you on the show for ages.
I'm sorry, my time is up.
No, but what we thought we'd do.
Thank you for having me.
It is the holiday.
Merry Christmas,
everybody. Is the holiday season. Keith Lockhart from the BSO is one of the, from the Boston Pops is one of the participants. To get people in the mood, what we thought we'd do is we'd end this segment of Ask the Governor. A little quiz question for you. I can see you're pretty excited about that. Are you not?
Jim is very excited.
Okay, now here it is, Governor. Thank you for agreeing to do this. We're going to play something for you, and we want you to tell us, we want you to listen to it. Tell us why these two things are in the news. You ready, Governor?
Okay.
Okay, here they are. Please play them for the Governor, if you would.
And the winner is...
Okay, now, here it is. The question again, Governor, is... We repeat the question on the quiz. Are these two things in the news?
So, because they are the competing songs for rock song of the state.
Look
right
at
this.
He was sure you
said,
would have
not,
no idea.
The whole staff said, don't even ask him. The governor's going to know this in 2 seconds. I said, he is never going to know these two songs. Do you know what they are?
So one is Dream On.
Whoa,
by Aerosmith.
The other one's Roadrunner a guy is local from Natick, Jonathan Richmond. They were called the Modern Lovers. Now,
and the Aerosmith proponents didn't show up for the hearing.
Is that true?
I heard. Yes, and the people who proposed Aerosmith. And the proponents of the others and their fans apparently showed up.
You want to hear from one of the proponents? This may help you decide what to advocate for. Here's one of the proponents. You may know this guy. Here he is.
I have 25 days left in the legislature to try and move my bill along.
That particular person told us his remaining priority as legislator was to get. So which side are you on,
Governor? You got to love it.
No, that's Marty Walsh,
I'm going to sign the bill that comes before me. But I do, I do like radio. But when music comes on and Marjorie starts dancing, I think to myself, TV is missing something.
That's right. I tell you, I'm an undiscovered talent over here. I'm going to go on Dancing with the Stars. You can come with me, Governor.
If we can dance from our chairs.
Hey, Governor, we really appreciate your time. It's good to see you. Welcome back to the States.
I wish you a very joyful Christmas and a peaceful season, you and your listeners. And let us all hope for peace and blessings and wisdom in 2014.
Thank you. We share those thoughts. Thanks so much, Governor. We'll see you in January. Enjoy the new year.
Governor Deval Patrick joins us every month for Ask the Governor. Thanks again, Governor, for being here. When we come back, it is our news quiz, a special Pops Edition Year in Review Challenge with Keith Lockhart of the Boston Pops and WCRB's Brian McCreet. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today we're bringing you a Boston Pops holiday edition of our news quiz. Joining us to go over the local and national stories of 2013 are Boston Pops Orchestra Music Director. That'd be Keith Lockhart. Hello, Keith.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Nice to see you. And by the way, this track, I think it's pretty obvious to everybody, is from the Boston Pops Orchestra's first all-live holiday album of Boston Pops Christmas. Did you know that?
I knew it sounded familiar.
I knew. That's what you did. And his competitor today is WCRB's Brian McCreath. Brian produces both the BSO and Boston Pops broadcast. Hey, Brian.
Hey, good to be back.
We're very excited about this whole thing.
We are.
The Christmas spirit has just walked into the room here. Yeah, I've got my tickets for the 21st. I'm psyched. I'm ready to go.
Well, now we know.
Okay. Hey, speaking of that, I know you go to bostonpops.org to do the ticket thing and scheduling, but what's the deal with the 2013 holiday Pops? It's through Christmas Eve,
it
right?
It goes all the way through 5 o'clock or so on Christmas Eve on the 24th. And all told, I believe there are 37 public concerts in Symphony Hall. And I know it's a really popular ticket, so people should go to the website as soon as they can. But you should know that there's often a few seats left in there somewhere, and we'd love to have you with us.
I'm not going to make the same mistake I made last time, Keith, and refer to this as your pre-July 4th concert series. Is that okay?
I
learned my lesson. I did last time. I was appalled.
That's
now, Brian,
terrible. Yeah.
Radio listeners. What's the deal with radio listeners for those who are not lucky enough?
Yeah, we're going to have the Pops on the air on the 21st, as it turns out.
21st.
On the 21st. And then that's going to be repeated on Monday the 23rd. So there's two chances.
So you can still hear it, Marjorie.
Yes, that's right.
That's right. You can hear it back. But I got to say that as much as I love doing radio broadcasts from Symphony Hall, both the Pops and the BSO, there's nothing like being in the hall, so do not let that dissuade you from getting a seat, especially down on the floor.
It really is alive. The feeling of – we have too few of those these days in these kind of web-based days. The feeling of getting together in community and celebrating together is really
– And I'll tell you, my kids, when we go through the sort of holiday routine, hey, kids, what do you want to do this year? I say, Pops? Yes, definitely, Pops. That my kids
Big
love –
Big smile on Keith Lockhart's
face.
They love
being down there. Grandma's house and go, eh.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what – yeah, but no, they're like, where's the eggnog? Where's my table? And where's the eggnog?
Let me second that, because I think what's so brilliant about the Pops, you can be like an old person, you can be like 80, you can be somebody middle-aged, you can be 5, or you can be 25 when they're so critical of everything. You know it all, and they still want to go to the Pops. It has been a tradition in my family for years, and nobody ever complains.
For folks from 1 to 92.
There you go. There you go.
There's a little bit too much good feeling here. I want to bring this down. Before we start,
fix that, Jim, I'm
now,
sure.
Brian McCreath, before this started, Keith Lockhart, about 2 minutes ago, talked to me and was looking at you, and he said something like, is he my competition? How did you react to that? What did you say, Keith?
I said, is he my competition?
How did you take it?
Not with the snarky
whatever
tone you put in.
How did you take it, Brian?
I saw across the table a steely gaze looking at me, and I got shivers up and down my spine.
That's the way I saw it.
Okay.
In any case, first question goes from Marjorie Egan to Keith Lockhart. You ready, Keith?
Oh, boy.
Okay. Here we go. Sure. This man made big news this year in Boston. Who is he, and what dream did he fulfill?
I just want to just let you know the reason why I was late is that President Obama just called me to congratulate me. Let me tell you, my parents had big dreams for their kids, but I'm not sure it was this big.
Marty Walsh.
Very good. Very good. That distinctive Dorchester accent
could tell because of the West Coast accent.
Have you met him, by the way?
No, not yet, but he's coming to Pops for opening day, so he'll have a chance.
Oh, that's fabulous. Is
he going to read The Night Before Christmas?
It's a secret.
It's a secret. Okay, I'm sorry.
Good question, Marjorie. Now, Brian.
Yes. Jim, I haven't seen you. I haven't heard you read The Night Before Christmas.
I want that.
I can't believe you've been overlooked here.
Hello? talking to me?
Jim? You know, actually, would the two of you come and do it as kind of a point counterpoint sort of thing?
Absolutely. I was hoping you'd ask.
A very special evening.
Okay. I'll consider it. Now, in any case, I'd be honored. I would really be honored. In any case, Brian, you can tie the score because you are Keith Lockhart's competition here.
Brian, just call me Washington General.
Here you are. Here's a very famous North American in a recent TV interview. We'll ask you about this person on the other side of the clip, Brian.
Okay. I am changing my behavior. I'm working with a team of professionals, and I'm working out every day. But that's in my personal life. I was elected to go down to City Hall to end the gravy train.
And he does mean gravy, let me tell you. That's not fair.
I don't think he's ending the
guy. Okay, who would that be, Brian, please?
I think we're talking about the mayor of Toronto.
That would be exactly correct. Now, is he doing the night before Christmas, Keith?
I hope so. That's your sellout.
I'm sure he's doing something the night before Christmas.
How many things is he doing before
that? Yeah, the pictures of him like running into some city council meeting where he knocked everybody over.
He knocked that woman city councilor down on the ground inadvertently because he was running around the council chamber.
I think Saturday Night Live had him knocking down the whole Thanksgiving table.
I just saw that he showed up at a Buffalo Bills game yesterday.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I love Toronto, but he has made that town much more exciting than it's been.
Oh, I tell you, crack smoking mayors. Okay, here is MSNBC star Mike Barnicle in an interview with Daily Show correspondent Rob Corddry.
The real curse, if there is a curse with the Red Sox, is the curse of being owned by a bunch of crackers from Georgia. The Red Sox were the last franchise to have a black ball player.
So you don't believe in the curse of the Bambino?
No, there's no curse. The Bambino is a big fat bastard who could hit a home run and play the piano.
Okay. What happened this year to back up Mike Barnicle's claim that there is no such thing as the curse of the Bambino?
Well, I would guess he was referring to the worst-to-first season in our third World Series championship in
a decade.
That is correct.
I'm fully of Boston.
The Web Sox. Not the Web Sox, the Red Sox won the World Series.
So did anybody see how much David Ortiz's beard and the razor which shaved it off went for?
Oh, yeah, thousands and thousands.
More than 10 grand. Someone bought it in a plexiglass box. He had the whiskers.
Was it intact?
No.
Didn't they sell Babe Ruth's piano a few years ago? Like they pulled it out of some lake in Sudbury and they sold his piano.
Wow.
Did you hear about that?
I did not hear about
that. Yeah, I want to know the difference. I want to know, like, what did that sell for and what did David Ortiz's beard sell for?
I would bet that in this environment, Ortiz has went for even more dough, I would think. Yeah. So, Brian, you were behind by one point, but you have a chance to tie this up.
Falling behind. Yes. Oh,
you were
of course.
Behind. I went first.
Right. That's it.
Here's your question to tie this up, Brian McCreath. Here's a foreign correspondent from CBS News. What is he talking about in this particular dispatch?
He has only one lung. He lost one of his lungs in an operation when he was a child. So this is a man who knows suffering, and as everyone has said, he has lived a very humble life.
Okay, who is that? And it's not me. I know that it's tempting, but it's not. It's not. We don't have questions.
It's a fellow who runs around with a car with a big glass top on it. That would be Pope Francis.
That is exactly
correct.
You should get him for the night before Christmas. How great would that be? Hey, speaking of the night before, you have a CD out, which people are raving about, Keith
Lockhart. Right here.
We do Christmas with the Boston Pops live from Symphony Hall.
Yeah, it's great. And it's got all the classics on there, the sing-along and everything else.
And the 12 Days of Christmas.
I was going to say, you have that
modern classic.
The 12 Days of Christmas, it is just so brilliant. Tell people how you mix it up. It's not the usual 12 Days of Christmas.
Well, it is. I have to say, probably the best arrangement I've been responsible for getting somebody else to write by the very brilliant New York arranger, music theater guy named David Chase. It throws everything in the kitchen sink in. There is Mozart. There is Handel. There is Queen. Freddie Mercury is represented in there. There is the Tchaikovsky from The Nutcracker. The list goes on and on. It's absolutely incredible, but it's fun and festive. And, you know, if you just set the 12 days of Christmas normally, it's kind of like 99 bottles of beer on the wall.
And this is the Pop's first all live Christmas deal, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, first time we recorded it over 2 years, 2011-2012 seasons, multiple times, because as you can imagine, there's a lot of festivity going on in Symphony Hall, a lot of dropped champagne bottles and things like that. It really, I think, has succeeded in what the idea was, to try to capture the energy of the live performance. It's the third holiday album we've done since I've been with the Pops, but the first one that has tried to take you to being there.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. I don't know. Not sure which I like, but that or the sing-along at the end. I like them both.
Boy, you are really excited.
I am. I'm into
And by the
Christmas.
Way, she's this excited about this even when you're not here. I mean,
really,
all seriousness.
This is not just put on?
No, she is really wild about this.
I love Christmas caroling. I love Christmas sing-alongs, the whole thing. Okay, here's a question for you, Keith Lockhart. In this clip, up your alley, the newly minted Bostonian is talking about something he can do that his older predecessor could not.
Well, I'm quite young. I'm still able to dance on the stage.
Okay, who can dance around the stage?
Who can dance around the stage, I believe, is this.
Well, would it be our artistic director? No, that wouldn't be right. Let's see. Gee, I have no idea.
Yes,
I can dance
do.
Around the stage,
yes,
but that's
do.
Not my accent.
Someone else similar to you can also dance around the stage.
Mikko Nissinen?
No. What were you saying first?
That's what I was saying first.
Oh, it is?
No, let's see. Who can dance around the stage?
He's new.
He's new.
Oh!
Exactly.
My boss. Technically speaking, Andres Nilsson.
Is he your boss?
Yes.
I didn't know that. How is he your boss?
He is the music director of the parent company of the Boston Pops.
Okay.
So now, how's it going so far?
Well, we've met twice. He's a lovely man, and we both have young families. We've had a lot to talk about, and we're looking forward. He has a standing dinner invitation when he alights back in Boston long enough, and we're looking forward to a great artistic relationship. It's a little weird to finally have somebody in that position who is not quite young enough to be my kid, but getting there.
Now, Keith Lockhart, how different is it to conduct the Pops, which is a mix of all different kinds of music, and to conduct...
How embarrassed would you have been if I couldn't have gotten the answer?
It was a career ender, actually.
Sorry.
And to conduct the BSO, because, you know, the BSO is more, I suppose you'd say, serious music in some
sense.
Well,
it's just, I mean, frankly, it's my career has kind of stayed balanced between those two things, the traditional kind of straight symphonic expressions and what we do at the Pops. And it's all music. And with all of it, you try to inhabit the soul of the composer, what the intention was, and you try to play it with an authenticity and a belief behind it, no matter if it's Mahler or if it's Glenn Miller.
How do you inhabit the soul of the composer?
Ooh. 20 words or less. First off, you have to know, you have to be able to study long enough to be able to try to see what he was trying to say. You have to study enough to understand the gestalt that he was writing in, what came before him, what came after him, or her, I should say, in a non-sexist way. And you have to be able to communicate that all very succinctly to a group of very talented people.
Look at you nodding, Brian McCreath, the whole time he was talking.
I'm just thinking about Keith conducting, and I'm thinking about Andres conducting. And you know, Keith, I'll just jump in because you probably wouldn't say this yourself, but I think especially, you know, I'm thinking about that David Chase arrangement of 12 Days. You've got to love the music.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
And both of you do. I mean, both of you inhabit that music because you're so into it. When you're up there doing these 12 Days of Christmas, you can just tell you're really into it. And that's the case with Andres,
too. If you don't communicate that enthusiasm, the music won't leap off the page either for the players or the audience.
Right, right.
You know, very quickly, if you ever had to conduct music that you didn't like, I mean, we all have favorites. We all have things that we really do not like.
Well, I'm... Yes, the quick answer is yes. There are always things that one has to do.
Uh-huh.
There are concertos that somebody says, well, so-and-so is not offering anything other than this concerto. And I'm going, oh, but I hate that concerto. And then, then the trick is to not let anybody except yourself know that, or to find things to love that you previously couldn't find. But when you're choosing your own repertoire, I try really hard not to program anything that I can't at least fall in love with.
Yeah.
Because
but you think about the,
otherwise you're not a good proponent of
yeah.
it. There's somebody
and,
else who does love it. And
if you think
that.
About the players in the orchestra, they actually pretty much don't have any choice in the matter.
No, they don't.
They really do
they
have to find something to love in everything they do. And the BSO, the Boston Pops, I think one of the best bands in the world at finding that essence that they will latch onto and deliver. You
right.
know?
But I think in those players too, looking at the person on the podium can
yeah.
tell which music – which music means something to you.
Yeah.
And if you're faking it, that comes through.
Yeah, yeah. They can.
Hey, what'd you have to fake the most? What's the thing you hated the most, Keith, that you had to do? You were forced. By the way, we have Keith Lockhart from The Pops and Brian McCreath from WCRB. Come on, this is your opportunity.
I would never.
Spell it backwards.
Well,
come on.
I would. A couple drinks later.
Fine. I'll
can
see
I
you tonight.
Can I ask one more question? There are certain pieces that must be very unforgiving to play. Like if you were like a young pianist, you'd say a Bach Prelude and Fugue. You can't make a mistake because everybody notices it.
Does he know you were a pianist? I know you're going to say you weren't very good, but you were a pianist when you were a kid.
A little tiny pianist.
Just from her citation of a Bach Prelude and Fugue.
Well, you make a mistake, and if people know the music, it's very hard to cover that. It's obvious. But are there unforgiving things for an orchestra like that you can't kind of schmaltz your way through if you make a mistake?
The bigger and louder something is, generally the more host of sins can be swept under the rug.
I mean,
it's easier to do a compelling performance of Strauss' Heldenleben or even Rite of Spring than it is to do a compelling performance of a Mozart piece or a very delicate Ravel piece, Debussy, that sort of thing. Things that are incredibly transparent show all the errors. It's just like any other kind of artwork.
Yeah. It's awful when you see those errors, I suppose. But most of the time, the audience doesn't know,
do they? We try really hard.
Okay,
here's your opportunity to tie this thing up here, Brian McCreath. You ready?
I'm going to give it my best.
Here is Stephen Colbert talking about something that is really hard to get into.
50,000. To put that into perspective, that is fewer people than watch Up Late with Alec Baldwin. I mean, just look at the numbers, folks. That comes out to a 0.1% acceptance rate. Is 58 times harder to get into than Harvard. I mean, to get into you're really going to have to ace your MRIs.
So, Brian, what is proving to be harder to get into than Harvard?
Oh, I'm just glad that he mentioned the last thing there, the MRIs. This is the healthcare.gov.
That's exactly correct. This is
a little bit on the fence about this.
Supposedly it's better today.
Supposedly better, yeah.
Four highways in instead of two highways in or something
like that.
Is that
how they talk about it?
That's what they're saying.
Oh, okay, so it is a tie match, if I may call it this. We're moving to the fourth round, Marjorie.
Okay. Wow. A question for Keith Lockhart from the Boston Pops. In this news clip, what other than cows has been put to pasture?
Are you going to miss the cows?
I'm going to miss the cows. I'm going to miss the little Christmas hats on the cows. That was a big hit driving by. We were thinking of stealing a cow, actually.
Okay. Do you know what she's going to miss along with its cows?
I hear people have actually been stealing the cows. We're talking, of course, of that Bostonian landmark, the Hilltop Restaurant.
You are absolutely correct.
We will miss it very much in that cactus, that kind of faded neon cactus up there.
As much as we'll miss it, has anyone ever been there in this room?
Not me, but I've been by it.
I've been by the
70s.
Dinosaur miniature golf course. You were there in the 70s?
A million years ago.
How was that? Great?
Well, it was good then, but I think I heard it's not so good lately. So.
Well, it's definitely not good lately.
They were still selling leftovers
from
the 70s, actually.
Really.
Okay, before we go into the bonus round, you can go into the bonus round in a tie.
Oh,
WCRB's Brian McCreath, if you get this right. You ready?
Still my heart.
Okay, fine. Here's an impersonation of President Obama. In this clip, what government undertaking is Obama claiming to know absolutely nothing about?
My fellow Americans, first of all, it's true. The U.S. has been but the fact is I wasn't aware of it. Just because I'm president doesn't mean I know everything. Case in point, I just found out that the pumpkin spice latte not made with real pumpkins.
So here's the question, Brian. What government undertaking is the president or the faux president claiming to know absolutely nothing about? Do you know what it is?
I think he doesn't know anything about, so he says in this clip, about spying.
That is exactly correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
That?
Okay, we have one more. We're moving into the
bonus
round.
No, we don't. We're moving into the bonus round. Now, let me tell
you
what the bonus round thing is.
Multiple choice.
It is. But here, since both of you are part of the Boston Pops, we both agree, we're going to ask you about another Pops. That would be Kellogg's Sugar Corn Pops.
Oh. Yeah.
The breakfast cereal made from milled corn and sugar. Question one goes to Keith Lockhart.
Mm. Do you want to ask this question?
No, you're asking the question.
Okay, Keith. Which among these has been a real Sugar Pops mascot? Multiple choice, like I said. A, a squirrel carrying a hobo sack, which has corn pops spilling out of it.
Hmm.
B, like a scarecrow standing amid a field of corn pops. Or C, a porcupine carrying a yellow suitcase.
Wow. That is really tough.
Well, I personally, I would go for the porcupine, but I have to say I'm going to go for scarecrow.
Well, that would,
that would be incorrect.
We don't have a buzzer anymore.
I don't want to break your heart.
Now, you can steal this question, Brian McCreary.
I've got an opening.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, well, since I've already eliminated two of them, yes.
50-50 shot here, Brian. The hobo, the squirrel carrying a hobo sack or a porcupine carrying a yellow suitcase?
I just love the idea of the squirrel. I think it's a squirrel.
You may love the idea, but...
nobody else did.
Exactly. It was wrong.
Homeless squirrel on the homeless front of Kellogg's. That's nice.
Yeah, I don't know. Something about that.
Your first instinct was correct. Porcupine carrying a yellow suitcase.
Don't you love when people call it a porcupine? I for some reason,
what do I
love...
It?
No, not you. I love when kids call it a porcupine.
It's amazing.
Could you ask us a question about Snap, Crackle, and Pop?
Yeah, right.
That's coming, actually, in a couple of seconds.
See, that's got Pop in it, too.
Now, Brian, you can propel yourself into the lead.
Okay.
This is also multiple choice.
Still got an opening.
Which of these is a real Corn Pops tagline? You ready?
I'm ready.
A, it's Popnetic. B, Corn Pops, corn never tasted so good. Or C, they're Poptastic. A, B, or C, please. We've done a lot of research on this.
Wow.
So don't
I know.
Mess
how
with
long
it.
Did you spend? Fire that marketing company.
Don't worry about how much time we spent.
Staff.
Plenty.
I'm going to channel my inner madman.
Okay,
here.
Go ahead.
I think it's Poptastic.
Well, you think wrong. Now, Keith Lockhart, you can propel yourself into a significant lead near the end of the game.
Those were so memorable. I'm going to need to hear them again.
Here they are. The two remaining choices are A, it's Popnetic, or B, Corn Pops, corn never tasted so good. Is it A, Popnetic, or B, the corn never tasted so good thing?
I'm going to have to go for B, Alex.
Well, thank you. That was my dream in life, by the way. Oh, Alex Trebek. That would be wrong, Keith Lockhart.
Popnetic?
I've never heard of that either. Judges were sure it's Popnetic?
What does that even mean?
I have no idea. I don't think it really matters what it means.
They adhere to the side of the bowl?
Yes, it is. No, you adhere to the side of the bowl. That's what it means.
Just wait till they get in your tummy and see
what happens. Now, let me set this last question up. This is very exciting. Because we are tied.
Yeah.
While the question goes to Mr. Lockhart over here, Brian, if he gets it right, he takes home everything.
Oh,
if he gets it wrong and you get it right, you take home everything.
What is everything?
This is very dramatic.
What is everything?
Well, we don't have any prizes.
No, yes,
Jim.
We do.
We
have
do?
A box of Corn Pops. You know why? Because it's Popnetic, Marjorie.
Okay.
Oh, man. Does it have a porcupine on it?
Here we go. Question, the last bonus question. Which of these is a real-life convergence of sugar Corn Pops and the Boston Pops?
Ooh.
A, Arthur Fiedler's 1952 CBS radio broadcast was sponsored by Kellogg's Sugar Corn Pops. B, Leroy Anderson composed a 1960 jingle for Sugar Corn Pops. Or C, many Sugar Corn Pops ads have used John Williams' theme from Jaws.
But they're Popnetic.
Yeah, what does that mean? I mean,
there's a porcupine behind you. Oh my god!
You know, well, I'm gonna have to go for since we've been doing so well, Brian.
Yeah,
you may just win it all on this. I'm gonna have to go for A.
That is incorrect.
Whoa. Wow, this is really
exciting. We are left with two choices, Brian McCreath. Either Leroy Anderson composed a 1960 jingle for Sugar Corn Pops, or many Sugar Corn Pop ads have used John Williams' theme from Jaws.
Before he answers that, Leroy Anderson was you in the 60s? Is that the deal?
No, Leroy Anderson was Arthur Fiedler's principal arranger.
Oh, arranger.
In the 60s,
okay. Fine.
And I have done much Leroy Anderson.
Yeah,
know
Leroy.
The Anderson family. Have never been introduced to his theme for
Corn Pops. Well, we don't know if there is one, but we'll find out now, won't we?
Yeah, I guess we're going to find out. And with that in mind, I'm going with C.
You are correct.
Oh man.
John Williams' theme from Jaws. That is correct.
Just an objection, even if he's right. Just an objection. Why would anybody find that? Well, why would anybody want to eat Corn Pops after the Jaws theme?
That's an excellent point. Yeah, Keith a point for that point. So it ends up a tie.
Oh, no.
That was the best point that's been made in weeks on this show.
I got to tell you that Keith helped me out here.
How did he help you?
My first instinct was A as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was sure it must have been A,
but it wasn't. So in any case, now Keith.
I figured if it was Leroy Anderson, I figured Keith would definitely know if there was a Leroy Anderson jingle.
Very
for this.
Clever thinking. Yeah. Now, Keith, before you go, what's the deal? Tell us one more time. What's the deal with the 2013 Holiday Pops? Through when? When do they get tickets? How do they get tickets? What's
37 Holiday Pops concerts in total in Symphony Hall, as well as several in outlying areas around here in Worcester, Manchester, Providence. The best way to go is to go to bostonpops.org and look for a performance. Come join us all the way up through Christmas Eve.
Great. We're all going to be there. Merry Christmas, Keith Lockhart.
Thank you
Christmas
so much for coming in.
Now, Brian, the deal with the radio one more time,
right,
please.
Right, the 23rd. On the 21st and the 23rd, we'll have Pop's Christmas on the radio. And so I hope you can come to the radio and hear it. And it'll also be on our website.
So if Marjorie yells out something during the concert on the 21st,
I'll be in there in
she'll
the afternoon,
be on,
though.
Oh, that's
I'm
really,
at the 3 o'clock.
That is really unfortunate.
Well, yell anyway, Marjorie. Okay,
I'll yell anyway. Thank you very much, Brian.
Hey, my pleasure.
Great to see you both. Keith, great to see you.
To see you
and
too.
Thank
Brian,
you,
thanks.
Keith Lockhart from the Boston Pops.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in on Monday for our political roundtable. Film critic Garen Daly will also be here to tell you all about the things you don't know about the Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life. First, we're going to take President Barack Obama's press conference live right after our show, so keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH for that. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio.
I think, you know, even though apparently they're not broadcasting, I think you should yell out, "Hey Keith!" During the no, why wouldn't you do that? Just
well,
go.
Hey
Keith!
I have a sign made. It's yeah. Marjorie in row O. Can you give me a special sign? Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan,
and I am Jim Browdy.
Bye bye.
See ya.